You're listening to a Bookmark podcast. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten or omit some of the music chosen by our guests, but we hope you still enjoy listening.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 Radio with me, Lee Chambers. This is the show that talks about books and writing with a local slant. And on today's show, our theme is, well, it's sort of reflecting back on the past. Our studio guest is Ziba Talkani talking about her memoir, My Past is a Foreign Country. We'll also hear from Amelia Gentleman talking about her book, The Windrush Betrayal, Exposing the Hostile Environment, which details the mistreatment by the Home Office of descendants of the Windrush generation. And James Riley will chat to us about his book, The Bad Trip, an examination of the darker side of 60s counterculture. But Ziba, welcome to Bookmark.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Oh, no, it's lovely to have you here. We'll give you a proper introduction in just a moment. But nice to have you back in Cambridge. You spent time in Cambridge, didn't you?
I did, yes. I studied at Anglia Ruskin University. I did my master's in publishing here in 2012, 2013. And then I worked at ProQuest and I really enjoyed my time there. Yeah, it feels really good to be back.
And in your life, you've been to quite a few places. You were in Germany, Saudi Arabia, India. You're now in Cheltenham. Fond memories of, in different ways of those places, which we'll touch on later.
Yes, I've moved to London now.
Ah, okay.
So always moving. Yeah, Cambridge has been, I think, the place where I stayed the longest since leaving Saudi Arabia. And it's just been, it's been lovely to be back. And also just thinking about the huge changes that I went through in my life while I was in Cambridge. It's such an open and diverse place and so inclusive, and it was very it was a privilege to be here and to grow, I think. Yeah, definitely.
And do you revisit the other places?
I've been to Saudi because my parents still live there, and that's where I grew up, so I do consider that home, and I try going there every couple of years. Cheltenham, my in-laws live there, so I go there a lot more. And I took my husband to Germany, took him to Bremen, showed him where I lived, where I studied. And that was really lovely as well.
And we're going to touch on all those places because they're all in your wonderful memoir, which we'll be talking about throughout the show. But we'll play your first choice of music now, which is Nina Simone and Feeling Good. Why this one?
It just lifts me up. It's a song that I know what I'm expecting, and I know that it will make me feel better after I've listened to it.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. New life for me. Ooh, 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 ooh. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel.
That's Feeling Good by the wonderful Nina Simone, the first choice of music on Bookmark today from our studio guest Ziba Talkani. Ziba has written for the Saudi Gazette, the Manipal Journal, Wasafari and the Nasty Women anthology. Her memoir, My Past is a Foreign Country, was published earlier this year. Subtitled A Muslim Feminist Finds Herself, it recounts her upbringing in Saudi Arabia and her journey to find freedom in self-expression in India, Germany and the UK. She tells how she fought for the right to be defined as a Muslim feminist and forge her own way in life. Vogue described the writing as disarmingly honest, and Preeti Taneja, author of the award-winning We That Are Young and a former guest on Bookmark, I might say, described it as a beautiful and important book which belongs at the centre of our cultural life. Well, Ziba, wonderful remarks there. How old are you? You seem very young to write a memoir.
I'm 28.
28, that is quite young, yes, to write a memoir, but clearly you felt you had to write it.
Yes, I think it was being a Muslim, being a person of colour, a woman of colour, a Muslim women of colour in the UK at this time feels a very interesting identity to occupy. And I think what the way the media deals with my identities, I find that very interesting. And it felt like the right time to share my story in my own voice rather than having other people speak for me, and other people who probably don't understand me or understand my experiences. And there's so many different ways to be a Muslim woman in the 21st century. And yeah, that was one of the reasons why I felt it was very important to write this now rather than wait.
And you described how Muslim women are talked about in the UK as callous.
Yes, yes, I definitely feel that way. And I think that comes from a place of not knowing. And there's not enough in the mainstream about what it truly feels to be a Muslim woman. I think there's a lot of interest in the way we dress and the way we are being treated rather than how we feel. And I feel like that's where that disconnect comes from. I don't think it's bad intentions, it's just a lack of knowledge. There are not enough Muslim women at the table to share their views, and I think that's one of the reasons, and I feel the need to step up.
And Muslim and feminism are not words that are often put together in the press.
No, not at all. In fact, one of the questions that I've been getting a lot this year since my book came out is, how is it possible to be Muslim and feminist? And I find that so interesting, because a lot of the women that I know are both, and it's not a contradiction in our own minds. So I find it interesting that I need to then justify my beliefs to people who don't properly understand where Islam comes from.
And you talk in the book how you began to question how the Quran was being translated and interpreted. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Of course, yes. So I grew up in Saudi Arabia. I lived there for the first 17 years of my life. And the culture in Saudi Arabia is it's a certain strain of Islam that's quite strict. And I believe because they're the custodian of the two holy mosques, they have a reason to uphold that, I suppose. But growing up in such a strict Muslim country made it very difficult for me to be the kind of Muslim I wanted to be. I was reading the Quran and I was reading about how merciful our God is and how the stories of our Prophet, and none of that were aligning or sitting well with the misogynistic or homophobic strains of Islam that I was seeing being practiced around me while I was growing up. So very early on I felt this disconnect, and I felt like things were not the way they should be. So I started trying to study the Quran, the translation of the Quran, by myself rather than having the teachers explain things to me, because I believe that also comes from their own interpretations. And that really helped, I think. It helped me learn a bit more. It helped me understand. And one of the things, one of the very important tenets of Islam is to seek knowledge. And I find that very interesting that in some cultures, we are not allowed to think freely for ourselves, and I want to change that.
And as we were saying, you've lived in various places over the years, so has the reaction to how you've interpreted the Quran changed depending on where you've lived?
Yes, I think so. So I am Indian and my parents are Indian. So we would go back to India every year. And that was very interesting because we came from a Muslim community in India as well, and from a Muslim family. And the way they practiced Islam was just so different from the way Saudi Arabia practiced Islam. So very early on, I could see that there were different ways to be a good Muslim. And it was not one way was not wrong. And I think moving to Europe and learning very different things. I think the thing about Germany, so that was the first time I lived in Europe, in Germany, in Bremen, to see Muslim female scholars, which I'd never seen before. I'd never seen that in Saudi Arabia, and I'd never seen that in India. And that just shook me. I think that was just such a, to see that visible representation and to see women take control of that and to be so learned. And I think that really changed the way I interpreted Islam and the way you internalize so many things that you learn as a kid. And I think it's very easy to internalize misogyny. It's just something that you don't question. And then when you see something else, you think, oh, wow, there's a different way to be. And that's what I want to be.
And up till then, one of the female role models in your life had been your mother. And she is a big, big part of this memoir. You say, Mama's silence was a big part of my early years. So tell me about your mother.
So I think, as is common with mother-daughter relationships, ours was not an easy one, especially when I was a teenager. And I also think that the patriarchy plays a huge part in how difficult mother-daughter relationships can be, and just relationships between women within the patriarchy. And I have never experienced a patriarchy as strict as the Saudi culture. And I think taking away mama's freedom through her not being able to drive, her not being able to do a job that she wanted to do because it was very limited at that time, especially in the 90s. And I found that very, I think that had a huge impact on our relationship, definitely. So there were lots of silences, and it was very difficult to be a feminist at that time because you just couldn't, there was no connection and there was no sisterhood, or at least as a child, I couldn't see it. So I was not able to be mobile and take the experiences of other women in. So all I had was my mum, so my focus was on her. And I think it was just so claustrophobic as well, in a way. My father used to travel a lot when I was growing up. He'd go away for 2 or 3 weeks, which meant that my mum would not leave the house for that long, because we were not allowed to leave the house without my dad or a male guardian. And I feel like that also had an impact on our relationship. We're just shaving away at each other. I think that's very difficult. But we have a really good relationship now. She's very proud of my book. She's very proud of me having a voice. She came to the book launch, which was really supportive of her. And also, how amazing to have a mother who gives you permission to write about all of her weak moments from when she was so young, in her 20s. She was 23 when I was born. And I think it's just glorious that we are learning together, we are learning from each other, and we are working away at our relationship, which I don't get to see that much.
And that's one of the journeys of the memoir, is how you come to re-examine your mum and your dad.
Yes.
Yes, I did want to know what they thought about how they were presented in the book, because it's not always kindly, really, because it's through your eyes.
Yes. And I think, especially in the beginning, and when I was younger, I was not able to empathize with my parents. I was not able to understand where they came from, and that created a lot of conflict. And for me, it was very important to stay true to that conflict, because I believe that it shaped me. So earlier on in the book, they don't come off as empathetic or understanding, because that's how I felt, but that doesn't mean that that's how they were. And later on in life, you see that we grow together and we understand each other. I feel like what sets my parents apart from other parents in my community is that they always listened, even if they didn't agree with me, even if they didn't believe the same things that I did. There was a desire in them to understand their daughter. There was a desire in them to help me. And I think they could sense that I was not being petulant. I was just trying to be my best self, and I was trying to find happiness. And I think they also struggled with the idea that their child was not happy with the things that were making them happy, that was giving them happiness. It was, I think they also felt like I was rejecting everything that they'd worked hard for and all the life that they'd tried to create for me. So I can understand why that was also difficult for them. I have a lot of empathy for them now. They've been really supportive. My mother has not read the book.
She's not read it?
No, she's not read the book. She made a choice not to, but she was, she knows what's in it. And I did take her permission to write some of the things, and she was okay with me to do that. But I also, it doesn't upset me that she has not read the book, because I feel like it's very unfair that for the sake of my art, I don't want to force the revisiting of the trauma. I don't want her to have to go through the tough times in her life, because you can see in the book that it's been a journey for her as well. She has also grown in the last 28 years, and she has just changed her life around. She has made the best in a place that was not always encouraging of that. She has a great job. She really enjoys the life she has. She has amazing friends, and she likes being in Saudi Arabia, and I respect that. And I feel like what we wanted and what we want in life is different, and we both respect that. And I think that helps our relationship a lot.
Was it always inevitable you were going to write this memoir? I mean, you've always been drawn, it seems, to words and self-expression through writing.
Yes, I started writing when I was 13. I don't know if I had I wouldn't say that I've always had the courage to think that I could write a memoir. I always tried to fictionalize my story. There was a lot that was in me that I wanted to share and which I felt was valuable, that needed to be shared. But the idea of burying yourself the way I did in this book was something that I became comfortable with very recently and just immediately wrote it without giving myself a chance to think about it too much. But I think before that, it was, my parents always knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I don't think they were prepared for me to write a memoir. So it was an experience for all of us.
Well, thank you, Ziba. We'll come back and talk more about your book in just a moment. But we'll hear first from Amelia Gentleman. Amelia is a writer and reporter for The Guardian. Her work on exposing the Windrush scandal, the deportation of people from British colonies in the Caribbean who legally had a right of residence in the UK, earned her the Paul Foote Award and led to the resignation of the Home Secretary. She was also named as Journalist of the Year by, amongst others, the Political Studies Association and the British Journalism Awards. I met Amelia when she came to speak at Heather's Bookshop about her book, The Windrush Betrayal, and I asked her if when she'd received the first email alerting her to the actions of the Home Office, she'd realised the scale and significance of the story she was about to uncover.
Well, the story itself was really disturbing. I don't think I realised that it was going to be something that was going to preoccupy me for 2 years or that was going to develop into such a national scandal. But the details in that email were in themselves really shocking. I was sent the email by a woman from an organisation called the Refugee and Migrant Centre in Wolverhampton. And they were really concerned about Paulette Wilson, who was 61 at the time, who'd arrived in Britain aged 10 from Jamaica, had lived here all her life since then, had worked here, been to school here, and who'd been wrongly classified by the Home Office as being here illegally, and who was at that time in Yarl's Wood, a really notorious immigration removal centre, and had been told that she was going to be sent back on a flight to Jamaica within days. The idea that a grandmother who'd lived here for 50 years, who'd worked in the House of Commons for a while as a cook, was about to be deported to a country where she hadn't been since she was 10 and where she didn't have close relatives. It just was, in itself, an astounding and awful story. So I didn't realise what it would turn into, but it was in itself very interesting.
And as you went on with the investigation, you met Paulette and you met others like her. Did that give you a sense of responsibility?
Yes, so I've interviewed in detail over 30 people, I think, who've had really, really difficult experiences at the hands of the Home Office. So some of them were wrongly sent back to countries that they'd left as children. Some were denied healthcare. Others lost their homes or were sacked from their jobs. And unusually, I suppose, with this bit of reporting, I've stayed in touch with most of them and I'm still talking to them now about their attempts to get compensation. So I have found it quite stressful at times, keeping all of these different people's problems really dancing around in my head. It's at times felt more like being an immigration caseworker than a journalist, because this hasn't been a story that I've just written and then moved on to the next thing. I think it's something that will stay with me for a long time.
Yes, you wrote about the personal impact on your own life. Why did you choose to share that and put that in the book?
I thought about it really hard. I've been a journalist for 20 years. I hate writing about myself. I'm not very keen on me journalism. But there were two reasons, really. I think because I was asking so many other people to absolutely lay their lives, what had happened to them, to talk about very revealing things, I thought it was a bit precious to keep myself entirely out of it. And also, I was writing about the process of being a journalist, explaining what it's like to be in the newsroom at The Guardian, what it's like to go to our morning conference. And actually, this was something that spilled out into my home life, in that it took me away from my children in the evening. It was something I was thinking about for a while, almost every weekend, constantly battling with phone calls from the Home Office at funny times of day. So, that was why. But it's an uncomfortable thing to give yourself away a bit like that.
So when you decided to make the reports into a book, how did you go about that? Did you just sew the reports together or did you rewrite them?
This is a totally new entity. So I think it would have been very unsatisfactory just to cut and paste all of the bits of journalism. Writing the book involved a whole new level of reporting. I went to Jamaica. I met people who'd been stuck in Jamaica for decades, people who've been trying to come back to Britain for years. I met Home Office whistleblowers. I talked to former cabinet ministers. I did a lot more research. I talked to as many people as I could. I think the frustrating thing about being a journalist is that you have to squeeze all of the information into really very tight bits of space, very restricted numbers of words. And all the way along, as I was talking to people during the initial investigations, I was so fascinated by the whole life stories that had culminated in these Home Office problems. And writing the book allowed me to talk about people's arrival in Britain in the 1950s, in the 1960s, what that was like, the kind of very, very painful departure from the Caribbean and the shattering of families. So the book is largely about the Home Office and the scandal, but it's also about that migration story. And it's a story of what it's like to be a journalist at the centre, suddenly, of a political scandal.
And how did it feel? I mean, your journalism has changed things for people. How does that feel?
At the time, it felt unbelievably stressful. I did feel really optimistic a year ago that an enormous amount had changed for the better. We had apologies from Amber Rudd, who resigned as Home Secretary, and from Theresa May. She was forced to apologise repeatedly. And then we saw Sajid Javid come in as Home Secretary and make some really quite radical suggestions that there would be reform and that compensation would be paid. And Sajid Javid said he wanted the Home Office to become a more compassionate institution. And so I thought, you know, that that was wonderful. And I did feel that that was a real example of journalism forcing positive results. I feel a bit more muted now, I suppose. 18 months on, we're still waiting for the compensation to be paid and the reform hasn't happened. But it's undeniably true that a lot of people have had a positive result from this. We've seen 8,000 people get paperwork that they didn't previously have and that they do now have. So that does make me feel happy.
And do you feel that justice has been done? Whoever started this, can you pin it back to one individual or to a particular policy, and has that been changed?
I think it really developed under the administration of David Cameron and Theresa May, and we have seen apologies, numerous apologies from Theresa May. I don't think that the problem has been solved because the underlying legislation that created the hostile environment remains in place, and there still hasn't been much of a kind of wider discussion about whether or not we really want to have that kind of legislation in place. So I think that there's still work to be done, and that's one of the reasons I'm really happy to have written this book and to still be talking about it and reminding people that this is an unresolved issue.
And what kind of reaction have you had from the people whose stories you told?
It's a difficult thing to put your life out, particularly in a newspaper, I think, to talk about your immigration problems underneath a headline that hints that you're an illegal immigrant. It was really brave of all of those people who were having immense difficulties to come forward and agree to be interviewed and to be photographed. But I think most of them have felt very positive about their role in bringing this to light and their role in forcing change. So yes, they've all been happy. I've sent them all copies and no one's told me they hate it.
And do you think something like this could happen again? I know circumstances have changed, but in terms of how we view or how officially a particular group of migrants is viewed and treated?
I'm really interested in looking at the moment at what's happening with the EU residents who are currently living in the UK, who have to go through a process of registering and applying for settled status here so that they can remain as legal residents after Brexit or a year after Brexit. The Home Office has learnt some of the lessons from Windrush, but there's still immense anxiety that there will be large numbers of people who will struggle to get their status under this scheme. And because there are 3.4 million or so EU nationals living in the UK. There are so many that even if the Home Office's scheme is very successful, it's quite likely that we'll see over 100,000 people left out and possibly pushed into the embrace of the hostile environment in exactly the way that we saw with the people in the Windrush scandal, unable to keep their jobs, unable to stay in their housing, finding it difficult to travel or get access to healthcare. So it's a really acute and still very relevant issue.
And what's next for you? Have you got another book in mind?
I don't have another book plan. One of my parallel interests has been around trafficking from Vietnam, which I've been looking at in the last few days because of this tragic incident with the lorries. So I'll be looking a lot at that. I'm hoping to focus on something more upbeat if I can, but I've yet to find that theme.
And The Windrush Betrayal, Exposing the Hostile Environment by Amelia Gentleman is published by Guardian Faber Publishing. With me in the studio is Ziba Talkani talking about her memoir, My Past is a Foreign Country. Ziba, you studied journalism. Was that the kind of journalism that you were thinking you might enjoy, that kind of campaigning journalism?
Yes, definitely. And I studied journalism in India, and my parents were always worried for me for doing the kind of things that I wanted to do in India. And I think they were one of the reasons why I didn't become a journalist. It's just when you're in a country with a democracy as new as India, there's so much to report on and so many changes that you want to be a part of. Yeah, it's just amazing to see what Amelia has achieved.
And one of the things we haven't spoken about, which is in the memoir and a big part of the memoir, is hair loss, because you speak very candidly about this. This started when you were quite young.
Yes, I think I was around 12 or 13 when it started. And yes, it's a big part of my life. So it was very important for me to be able to write about it in the memoir. And I found it quite healing to be as candid. A lot of people who read the book did not know that about me. And that's just how my life has been around my hair loss, where growing up, I was never made to feel comfortable about it, and it became a thing that I needed to hide. My parents, especially my mum, was quite nervous about my hair loss as well, and it became something bigger than hair. My mum was just not able to deal with it, and it just created a lot of grief for her. And sometimes as a teenager, I would walk into a room and my mum would look up from what she was doing and she would see me and start crying, and that was a huge burden to carry for something that was obviously not my fault and something that my body could not do. But the expectations for women to look a certain way and to conform to certain beauty standards are so strong within my community. And one of the reasons why my mother was so nervous for me was because she worried that no one would want to marry me, and that was not one of my concerns when I was growing up, but something that she really, really worried about a lot. This also led, and because of that, I think, and because of all these fears, I was not allowed to share my experience with anyone. So I was very quiet about it. A lot of my friends did not know what I was going through either. So the act of writing about it for the first time and sharing about it for the first time was quite empowering for me in terms of just taking control of my narrative, no longer carrying the shame that other people tried to place on me for not being beautiful. And I found that very interesting, how strongly people react to beauty or the lack of beauty, and then my desire to not want to be beautiful or to work towards that, which I think also made people nervous when I was growing up. So yes, it's been an amazing experience to finally be able to share that part of my life, and then to hear similar stories from other people who have read the book, and for them to write to me and say they've been going through the same thing since they were teenagers. And it's just also shocked me how many people within my community and even in my family have suffered hair loss, women specifically, from a young age. And to think that I grew up so isolated and that there was no reason to feel that way.
Well, it's a very brave book indeed, Ziba. Let's listen to your second choice of music now, which is Nancy Sinatra, These Boots Are Made for Walking.
Yes.
Why this one?
I listened to the song for the first time when I went to visit a friend, and her elder sister was playing the song and dancing in her room, and I caught a little glimpse of her through a half-closed door, and I think it just really amazed me, this feminist voice, which was so new to me then in Saudi Arabia.
me.
Bookmark with Lee Chambers on Cambridge 105 Radio.
With Heffer's Bookshop, the great Cambridge bookseller since 1876.
Our aspirations, rather than books.
And our guest today on Bookmark is Ziba Telkhani, talking about her memoir, The Past is a Foreign Country. Ziba, we touched on that a little bit before the music there about marriage and marriageability. And you detail, you talk through the experiences of your friends who go through the arranged marriage process. It's quite shocking, the misogyny and the cruelty that they experience.
Yes, it's very shocking. And I think especially after I left home, I left Saudi Arabia when I was 17, and to be existing in a completely different world, and it was such a shock to see that some of my friends were still experiencing a lot of the things that I thought was something that we didn't accept anymore and something that was not allowed anymore or shouldn't be allowed. It just felt like I was walking back in time every time I revisited home and went back to them. And it's unfortunate. And I think that there will be change. I think there is change in every generation. Things get better. And I feel like the women in my life, my friends, are just such amazing and brave women. And they're trying so hard with the experiences that they're going through and within the confines that are placed on them. I feel quite lucky because my parents still believed in giving me the right to choose, and it's such an odd statement to make that I was lucky because of my parents, and it should never be that way. No one should have that kind of power over you. So yes, it hurts me deeply, but it was also very empowering for my friends to read their stories in the book. They were very happy for me to write about that and for others to see that. And they felt that it gave them a voice and it made them stronger in their journey.
Yes, your own story has a happy ending, and in your marriage vows, equality featured in your marriage vows. Your husband promised equality.
Yes.
So your marriage is quite different to a lot in the community.
Yes, definitely. And that also made people nervous. It was not an easy transition, I don't think. Just a husband who cares for his wife or who is interested in making sure that she is happy and things are going well. It was very interesting to me that it's not only about being equal, and it's not only about trying to work on your own relationships, but also how much interest that people within a patriarchal structure have in other people's relationships and in other people's business. And I feel like that's one of the reasons why the patriarchy still exists, that we enable it in so many different ways and we don't even realize how we are doing it. So I think after I got married, I just became suddenly aware of all the many ways that people try, the people are comfortable when you follow your gender roles, and when you don't, the different ways in which they try to push you back into your place or their idea of what your place should be.
And you say in the book, I use the word oppressed when sharing the experiences of women in my community, but I wonder if the correct word is traumatized. And are you referring to that process, or partly the arranged marriage process?
Yes, definitely. The arranged marriage process, and also the way a certain communities treat their women after they're married. There's such a huge disconnect between the way daughters are treated from daughter-in-laws, though to be fair, daughters don't fare that well either. And I find that very interesting. So when I got married and I decided not to be, for others to not decide how I choose to be a wife or the way I choose to live my life after I get married, or for marriage to define me, there was a lot of resistance in the way I was choosing to live my life. I was not hurting anyone and I was not getting in anyone's way, but still there was a lot of resistance. And at first I got really angry because I felt like all these other women could not tolerate my happiness, or they didn't want me to be free, and I held that against them. But very soon I realized that probably it's not about them trying to oppress me, but by being myself, I was reminding them of the choices that they didn't think I had. And that's trauma. And you don't want to be reminded of the things that you could have done or you couldn't do. And it must be very disturbing also for them to occupy the same spaces as me, and then for me to not follow the rules, it must make them question why they followed the rules and what was the point of living 20, 30 years in a way that was not making them happy. So I'm definitely a lot more empathetic, and I think the problem is the patriarchy and not the women who oppress each other or enable the patriarchy.
Thank you, Ziba. We'll come back to you and chat a little bit more in just a moment. We'll talk now about a time that is well before your time, not before mine, unfortunately, the 60s. James Riley is fellow and college lecturer in English at Girton College, Cambridge. His book, The Bad Trip, Dark Omens, New Worlds and the End of the 60s, explores the dark side of 1960s counterculture. Record Collector magazine described it as refreshingly deep and provocatively different, reinstalling the art of good writing. And the Sunday Times described it as dense with conspiracies, chaos and apocalyptic death drives. The Bad Trip is a history that makes perfect sense when the sky is falling down. When I met James, I asked him why he'd chosen to write about this subject.
I've always been very interested in the 1960s. I grew up listening to things like Sounds of the 60s on Radio 2. I was a very big fan of all the reruns of things like The Prisoner, The Avengers, Danger Man. But even through thinking through its vibrancy and really enjoying all the energy that came out of the popular culture of the decade, I was attracted to the slightly darker side of it. Not as a kind of attempt to be counter-argumentative about it, but the fact that there was something slightly more sinister and something darker even within the brightest, most day-glow moments of the culture of that decade. So for all the songs and images about love, there's a lot of thinking about the apocalypse, the end of the world, occultism.
And when you started to investigate this, how dark did it go?
Very quickly. As I was getting into this, just thinking, is there something here or is this just my interest? Along with a friend of mine, the artist and writer Evie Salmon, we were involved in organising an exhibition of art from the rave era. And there was an artist called Luke Insect, and he'd done a series of large images that were sort of like stained glass windows using imagery from the 1960s. And he'd done one called The 13th Order, which was a picture of Grace Slick from Jefferson Airplane. But it was a photograph of her giving something of an obscene gesture to the camera, but framed as a stained glass window, suffused with psychedelic colours. That stuck in my mind as this gateway, if you like, to a certain version of psychedelia, but had a kind of attitude and an anger and an aggression built into it. Sometime later, after I'd written an academic article about the cult of Charles Manson, I woke up to a number of emails and missed calls from the BBC and from the University Communications Office telling me, would I be available to talk about Charles Manson? Because a series of reports had emerged that he'd been taken into hospital. And I said that I would be able to talk. And then the response that I got from the BBC was, we'll ring you if he dies. And it felt slightly strange to be, however distantly, but tangentially linked to a figure like Charles Manson, who even then was still held such a resonance and such an energy. And I guess that's also what I wanted to actually consider through this. What is that resonant energy that still pulsates through the popular history of this decade?
And I suppose the big question is why there was this dark side to the 60s. Was it that all bets were off, really? The rules were changing?
There's a lot of terrible things happening in that time. The 1960s are a period where there's an exponential rise in nuclear testing. The decade begins with concerted attempts on the part of groups like CND to try to push for political policy against this testing, but that doesn't really develop in the way that it wants to. So if you like, the decade begins with a certain degree of anxiety, frustration at the political situation. Vietnam blossoms into a state of almost globalized warfare. There is a deep sense of what we would now refer to as Cold War anxiety, a sense that this is a turning point within culture, but it's a turning point which could go quite quickly into a period of crisis, if not catastrophe. They speak of the world ending. They speak of either something has to change because the world is so terrible, or there is a change coming which is so magnificent and seismic, it is going to be the end of the world as we know it. So this is what I was trying to get at, in the sense of I'm not just sketching out the sort of darker, hidden elements of the 60s, but I'm trying to look at these other strains within the more well-known elements, if you like, the lighter side of it, the kind of day-glow psychedelic element of it. we think about the 1960s and we think about the Summer of Love, and we think about All You Need Is Love from the Beatles, and we think about this pervasive language of love, which is moving through the decade and in and out of the counterculture. Those calls for love and that emphasis for love are so intense and sincere because love, care and respect seem to be so sorely lacking elsewhere.
And how influential were pop stars and figures like that? Because they were very publicly living a hedonistic lifestyle in a way that maybe musicians hadn't lived before.
Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of money circulating. Obviously, these lifestyles are expensive. There's a lot of key rock stars and key figures from the music industry who, when we look back on them, do live like arrogant princelings. This links back to, you know, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. And certainly within the Stones camp, entourage, court, whatever you want to call it, enormous amounts of sort of decadence and sort of arrogance and conspicuous consumption. They were not exactly a kind of isolated sovereign royal bubble. There's elements of that. And when we think about certain sectors of what we might point to as the British counterculture, often we are actually talking about a kind of hive in a certain affluent area of London. But at the same time, Paul McCartney was investing and covertly funding the International Times. If you look at the cover of Sgt. Pepper, it's punctuated with figures from the avant-garde and the underground, like William Burroughs, for example. The Rolling Stones were linked to people like Kenneth Anger, the filmmaker and magician, Donald Cammell, the writer and co-director of Performance, which is something of a document of that whole period. So, yes, they were celebrities. Yes, they have a lot of money at their disposal. Yes, they sort of exemplify this sense of social mobility and social aspiration. But that does not mean to say that they were separated from and in a state of royal refusal of what we might refer to as the underground and the avant-garde. They were a lot more engaged and productive and creative in relation to those more fringe arts than we might assume.
And did you find anything that shocked you?
Lots of things that shocked
really?
Me. Yeah, lots of things that shocked me. I found it very difficult to write about Charles Manson. It's a difficult subject. It's well known, but the level of violence and misanthropy is breathtaking. Same thing with writing about Altamont. It's a semi-legendary event in which the Rolling Stones put on this concert at this speedway in California in December 1969. It's very badly organised. The security is provided by the Hells Angels. They're paid in beer to do this. Someone is beaten and stabbed to death by the Hells Angels in full view of the stage, and this is all captured on a film called Gimme Shelter. I guess what actually shocked me was the sheer number of checks and balances that were sort of ignored. Occasionally, some of the accounts put it across as some kind of anomaly, but it was a combination of a certain degree of arrogance, a massive sense of mismanagement, a complete misunderstanding and a disregard for the way in which certain music scenes operate.
And do you think there's anything we can learn for today from looking at the 60s?
Yes, very much. In fact, what I would like people to look at when they read this book is the shock of difference. We're living in interesting times, strange and difficult times where there is a lot to protest about. Obviously from the spectrum of the environmental crisis, gender and race issues and issues linked to the socio-political chaos that we are moving through. All these things need attention. And we can look to the lessons of the countercultural impetus. There is a comparable sector protesting about very similar issues. But I think the thing that we also need to keep in mind is when we compare countercultural and protest playbooks, as it were, the parameters and the targets, the institutions that we might wish to protest against are very different. And they operate in very different ways. If we think about the level of protest that was directed towards, say, the Nixon administration, Richard Nixon gets into the White House in January 1969, and he gets in on an election ticket, which is basically quite explicitly viewing the counterculture as a kind of seditious fifth column within society. I mean, it's clear from the campaign materials. When Watergate spirals, it's very clear the parameters of the problem there. Here's someone who gets in on a ticket of law and order and then seems to be disregarding both. What he actually is completely different to his public persona. Compare that to our current leaders, Donald Trump, Boris Johnson, Vladimir Putin. That reality and actuality underneath just isn't there anymore. It's difficult to even say what they actually believe in. Their policies seem to strategically change from one tweet to the next, from one day to the next. So in terms of the actual protest movement, it's almost as if the target is strategically fluid and is strategically moving all the time. It's as if we're entering a period of deeply ambiguous, intentionally liquid postmodern politics, in which it's very difficult to define clearly the lines of approach in terms of marshalling a protest gesture. If the goalposts are always moving, if the target, as it were, is always moving, it's very difficult to get that activity into some kind of policy-based and practical results. And I think that a lot of political discourse in the current period is constantly attempting to mask itself and evade that kind of criticism. So I would like people to look at the book and get a sense of that difference and get a sense of the fact that it is an exemplary protest culture, but in many ways it's not going to work in the present period. The playbook, the toolkit, and the set of strategies need to change.
And The Bad Trip by James Riley is published by Icon Books. I ought to say that if you do like your 60s and you like your 60s music, then tune into Cambridge 105 Radio between 8 and 10 on a Sunday morning when we have Sounds of the 60s with the lovely John Gannon. We've been talking today on Bookmark to Ziba Talkani about her book, My Past is a Foreign Country, which is published by Sector. Before we say goodbye, Ziba, let's bring ourselves up to date with where you are now. You describe yourself as a work in progress.
Yes, I feel like there's still a lot that needs to be done. And with my feminism especially, I felt like it's not complete until it includes my mum. And I mean, it includes that generation of women from my community as well. And there's just so many obstacles between them feeling free and them being able to access self-care without guilt. So I feel like that's what I want to do now. There are a lot of mobilized young Muslim women doing amazing work and activism and taking care of themselves and being valued for the work that they do. And I feel like our mothers and grandmothers deserve the same space.
And you say of yourself that you apply to yourself, I think the term you use is radical self-care.
Yes, that's a big part of my remaining zen. I think that's very important because there's the burnout in the current times with all the atrocities that you see around you, the things that you witness, everything that keeps going wrong, things like climate change as big as that. It's very difficult to stay on top of things and to feel like you're making valuable contributions to the things around you. So I believe in radical self-care, and it can be anything from taking time to read my book or just having a bath if that's what I want to do, but also includes being accountable for the spaces that I occupy, being very self-aware, and also being constantly in touch with my privilege, because I feel that a lot of the issues that we are going through right now politically and otherwise tend to be because people are blind to their privileges. And while I talk about the things that have gone wrong in my life, I'm also very aware of my privileges. My father's money especially is what's cushioned my life and made it possible for me to live in all these places. And I think that really helps.
And what next for you? Are you going to write a follow-up or write fiction or something else?
I'm trying my hand at fiction. I also work in publishing, so I feel like that's where my heart is at right now. I work for Bloomsbury Publishing. I'm a production editor, and I really enjoy doing that. I don't know if there is a need for a follow-up. I feel so free and liberated from having written my story from a time where I was not allowed to share my story, and now I feel quite empowered and I talk quite openly and I share my story continuously online on Instagram and Twitter. So there is no need for me to have to reflect back on a time that I'm constantly reflecting on anyway.
And a question that we ask all our guests on Bookmark: what are you reading at the moment?
I just finished reading Celia Paul's Self-Portrait, which is a very beautiful full colour book with over 60 of her paintings, and a very fascinating memoir of being a young woman. So she writes a lot about Lucian Freud and her relationship, and also a writes about her mother and her son, which I found very fascinating. And she lives very close to where I work, her studio flat. She needs to take 80 steps to get there. And the freedom that she has to paint and the freedom that her son gave her made me reflect on the things that I expect from my mother, and maybe I need to take a step back and let her be.
Well, thank you, Zeeb. It's been great talking to you. We'll come back to you in just a moment for your last choice of music. But heads up that our next show is a Christmas show, would you believe? And we'll be joined by Heffer's crime fiction expert, Richard Reynolds, to reflect on the year's best crime books. And he'll be giving some tips for presents for Christmas for fans of crime fiction. But we'll sign out now with your last choice of music, Zeeb, which is Anushka Shankar and Lasya. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes, I think so. I listened to a lot of Anushka Shankar when I was writing, because it was such a panic-inducing book to write, to revisit trauma and to revisit the act of things where you couldn't protect yourself as a child. And I found her very soothing.